launching your consulting career block by block, and looking back on life as a Tuck MBA. Hello and welcome. Thanks for joining me for this week's Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get that delightful instant when you can jump up and down and exclaim to the people staring at you, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. Today's guest, Jay Kenton Kvestu, graduated from UVA with a BA in Economics and History in 2006. Upon graduating, he joined Google in product development and worked there for 3 years until he moved to Hanover, New Hampshire to attend the Tuck School of Business and earn his MBA. He interned at BCG, but returned to mobile product development as a manager at Zynga when he graduated from Tuck in 2011. After several promotions, he joined Flurry. Also, immediately upon graduating from Tuck, he began to work on RocketBlox, where he is now full-time. We're going to learn much more about RocketBlox and Kenton's journey to date. Kenton, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure to have you. Okay, so first question, what is RocketBlox?
Good question. So RocketBlox is an interactive, skills-based platform that helps students prepare for consulting case interviews. We started the initial product back in 2011, and as you mentioned, it was a part-time role for myself and a few friends for a while, and has, as of recently, become a full-time role, and we're continuing to build out that product and business.
What are some of the interactive elements? I mean, are you, like, literally having case interviews with your computer? Or how does it? Can you give us a little bit more detail?
If you think about what a case interview is, there are variations across, you know, McKinsey to BCG to Bain to the other consulting firms, but ultimately all of those case interviews are essentially an interview which is testing a basket of skill sets. And so when we think about what those skill sets are that the consulting firms are looking for, there are very kind of consistent common threads that come up. So one of those skill sets might be the ability to do mental math very easily and comfortably, whether it's to do a market size calculation or gut check a profit estimate, that type of thing. Another one might be your ability to look at charts and data and easily kind of understand what those charts and data are communicating, be able to pull out insights from the next steps. A third might be your ability to structure a nebulous business problem. This is often how a case interview starts, with a very general kind of prompt, and be able to kind of construct a logical framework that would allow you to walk through that problem. So ultimately, when we say that RocketBlox is an interactive skills-based platform, what that means is we are really taking what are the key skill sets that are needed to succeed, not only in a consulting interview, but in the consulting job. And then we've built interactive drills that students can use to hone their abilities in each of those skill sets. So if you're struggling with mental math, we have a bunch of tools that help you prepare, drill yourself on mental math questions, and basically build your skill sets there. And same thing if you're struggling with the data analysis element of a case interview, or if you're struggling with the structuring element of, like, structuring an initial case problem.
Okay. And Can you, I guess you can't show us what the interactive element is, but can you describe it a little bit? I mean, is it a problem set? Is it something where, can you give us an example?
Sure. So let's take case structuring, for example.
Okay.
So say you're struggling with that part of the case review process. Our tools and drills will allow you to come into the system and go through a series of consulting case interview style case prompts. You'll be able to read the prompt, understand what the problem is, then be able to kind of submit or basically answer with your own framework of how you would address that problem. And then once you've submitted that, the system will give you a recommended answer, which comes from a former McKinsey, Bain, or BCG consultant. Mm-hmm. And then also let you compare your answer to a series of anonymous answers from other users on the platform. So it essentially gives you a way to practice answering that type of question. Compare your answer to a suggested answer from someone that has succeeded in these interviews and ultimately landed a job at one of the companies that the student might be looking at. And then also look at anonymous answers from other students that are going through the same type of interviews to get ideas and thoughts about how they could improve their own structures and frameworks as well.
Are the other students' answers rated or graded in some way by RocketBlocks?
Right now they're curated, and in the future we will have a rating system as well that we plan to launch in the coming months.
Okay, very interesting, fascinating. How did you come to found RocketBlocks? I mean, what's the backstory here?
Yeah, so I think the key part of the backstory is that when I was in business school at Dartmouth, I did an internship with BCG in the San Francisco office. Uh-huh. And I ultimately decided not to return to BCG, but when I was back at Tuck second year, I was helping a lot of my fellow students and some of the first years at that point prepare for their management consulting interviews. And myself and a friend, Nick, who happened to be like the McKinsey representative, staffed at Dartmouth campus, like recruiting on behalf of McKinsey. We were both kind of talking about the way we saw a lot of students preparing for these interviews, which tended to be like reading books, memorizing certain frameworks, memorizing various things like case systems, like do step one, do step two, do step three, and then like you solve the case. And the reality was that as we were talking about it, you know, it was very different than how I prepared myself for a case interview. And Nick, who was sitting there from the McKinsey perspective, was saying that he was seeing a lot of students come into the interviews that he knew were smart people because he had interacted with them, had great conversations with them, et cetera. But when they got into the case interview mindset and were actually sitting down doing the interview, they became almost like stilted and kind of wooden because they were trying to use techniques that they had memorized or trying to kind of jam a unique problem that was presented to them into some pre-existing framework. Mm-hmm. And so as we were talking about that, that problem and what we were seeing, the solution we thought was to actually put out a preparation tool that was focused on not teaching certain frameworks to memorize, but rather really building a pedagogical method around these are the skills that you need to demonstrate in this interview to succeed, and here are tools that are going to help you, like drills in each of those skill set areas that will help you get better at it. And so that was the initial kind of philosophy around how preparation should be done. That was kind of the founding spark, and that's ultimately what got built into the initial product and has evolved over the years.
Okay, great. All right, so let's go forward. So I can really understand that because I've read some of the – I've never been a management consultant, but I have read some of the case interviews and case interview prep books and some of the material. And on one hand, you know, frameworks can be useful, a framework for approaching anything. It gives you structure. It gives you an approach. But if you have 20 different frameworks to kind of sift through, then it would get confusing and stilting. And I'm sure there are going to be some situations that just don't fit the framework.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. So there's a million different frameworks out there. And some of those frameworks are very useful, especially when applied in the right situations. I think the way that I think a helpful kind of analogy to use is if you think about various types of like athletic endeavors, whether it's like team sports like hockey or soccer or more individual oriented sports like tennis, mm-hmm. like you will learn certain skill sets and drills that you will reapply throughout like a career playing that particular sport. But every situation that you face will be unique and you'll have to kind of figure out like how to really apply your skills in the right area. And so again, it's not that the frameworks and skills that you, like things that you may have memorized in the past are bad. It's just you need to get good at assessing a situation, a unique situation, and pulling out from like the tools you have in your toolkit to address it. Sometimes that might be a framework. Sometimes it might not be. Sometimes it might be a new hybrid that you've come up with where you take a framework and adjust it a little bit to meet the situation at hand.
Right, but it sounds to me like you're trying to give people skills to approach any situation.
Right, and so our problems that are in the system are modeled after real cases that exist, and we don't suggest that you use canned frameworks for any of them. The idea is really to find a unique kind of framework, and in the case we're talking about structuring problems, for any of these type of situations you might face.
Okay, now another question. How did you come up with the name Rocket Blocks?
Sure, good question. So the genesis of the name is that as we were thinking about this, the kind of working version of the product was actually called Blocks. And the reason the working version of the product as we were building it was called the internal project name was Blocks was because our approach was oriented around trying to teach and let students hone the fundamental building blocks that they needed to succeed in consulting interviews and ultimately the consulting job.
Right.
As you can imagine, when we actually needed to get things online and available, generally you have to go through the domain registration process and find a domain that's actually available, which is
right.
quite challenging these days.
Yes.
Blocks.com, definitely not available. So we were looking for like a riff off of that. We wanted to keep the element of blocks because we did really like the idea of building blocks as a motif and thought it fit well with how the product was oriented. And the combination of blocks plus rocket, which we really thought about like launching a career with the fundamental building blocks, made a lot of sense to us. So that was the ultimate genesis of the name.
Okay. Sounds that was interesting. Thank you. Now, there are other entities, resources, books, not to mention school career centers, that prepare wannabe consultants for case interviews and the consulting hiring process. What do you think is distinctive and unique about Rocket Blocks? What's its calling card?
So,
I'm on a roll.
There are a bunch of different entities, like you mentioned. So I'll speak about them in two buckets. So I think one, you have the career centers, which are great resources for the students to kind of navigate the career decision process. But what a lot of them, because they tend not to be large teams at the schools, they tend to be fairly narrow teams. And one of the things that they end up spending a lot of time and focusing on is coordination with bringing companies on campus, doing initial education around, these are the different career paths that exist, like here's kind of how the interview processes work.
Uh-huh.
They don't get as much into some of the super specialized mock interviewing. And even when they do, often the career centers run into the challenge of there's just like way too many students to effectively do like a bunch of mock interviews and really get into the nitty-gritty of preparing each individual student for a consulting interview.
Right.
Especially when there might only be one person, let's say Tux Business School, which is focused on consulting. It's just an overwhelming, like that ratio of students to counselors is overwhelming. So I think what happens is the career centers, for example, kind of focus on general education about career paths, profiles about the companies, getting students kind of pointed in the right direction and maybe navigating between them. But when it comes to like hardcore mock interview prep, they tend not to focus on that.
Okay.
When you look at the other resources that are out there, so things like Victor Chang's Case Interview Secrets book or Mark Cosentino's Case in Point book, a lot of the other resources out there are, they tend to be books, and they tend to have specific frameworks or systems that they teach students to essentially kind of memorize and reuse in the case interview. And so the key real differentiator is that Rocket Blocks is oriented to be, again, going back to where we started, an interactive skills-based platform. So the idea is, look, like Case in Point might help you get familiar with what the case interview process is really going to look like, give you a nice summary of the different types of cases you might experience. But just as I would not learn to become a good hockey player by reading a bunch of books about hockey or listening to a bunch of interviews that Wayne Gretzky did, you won't become great at case interviewing by just reading about it. You need to sit down. You need to practice it. And you need to practice, ultimately, the skills that end up being highly tested in a case interview. And so that's really where Rocket Blocks shines. a lot of students, you know, will pair it with doing a bunch of mock interviews with like friends and mm-hmm. you know, former McKinsey, Bain, BCG folks that happen to be on campus, and use RocketBlocks as a way to supplement when they realize, okay, I just did a case interview with a friend. I was really good at the math component. I'm really good with charts and data because like I come from an engineering background, but like I'm really struggling with structuring case problems up front. Mm-hmm. They can go into something like RocketBlocks and really hone their abilities on structuring, then come back and do another mock interview with a friend and try and see, are they actually improving their ability, as like really kind of taking a focused view on improving that skill set help them. And that's like the feedback we often get from students is that's really the value that they get out of RocketBlocks, is using it to really complement their mock interview process with friends and honing in on the specific skills where they realize, okay, you know, it might be the reverse. We have lots of folks that are like English majors, you know, they're the poets of the business school classes, and yeah. they say, you know, I'm doing okay with structuring, I'm doing okay with this, but like the quantitative elements of the case are really a struggle for me. And so, you know, once you know that, going and doing, you know, spending 8 hours doing eight more like full mock interview cases that only have like 5 minutes of math each might not be the best use of your prep time. But going and really drilling down on like, okay, reading a bunch of charts, analyzing them, doing math questions based off them, that will really help you. So that's like the type of thing that RocketBlocks really shines at.
Okay. Do you have any plans to add a mock interview service to your offerings to supplement the skills, the interactive skills that the platform currently teaches?
Yeah. I mean, I think our approach and goal is to really help students succeed in these interviews. Mm-hmm. Have not been the place that we started, but to the extent that our students and our users will get value out of that, and I think they definitely will, we would look to add it. So it's definitely something that's on our radar. It's definitely something that's come up in the past from our users. So we don't have any immediate plans to add mm-hmm. that type of product, but mm-hmm. I would not be surprised if we address it in the future.
Okay, great. Now, we've been focusing very much on the case interview, and that's clearly a key component in getting hired by one of the major strategy consulting firms. But stepping back a little bit and not being just focused on the interview component, what do you think is key to successfully navigating the consulting firm hiring process as a whole?
I think that, you know, putting the case aside, there's a few other things, mainly two other things that really jump out at me.
Okay.
So aside from being able to succeed in the case, improve your analytical chops and ability to structure questions, the consulting firms, I think across the board, generally really look for folks that have demonstrated leadership qualities and can communicate how they've utilized those in the past and the results of them. If you look at the type of work these firms doing they do, and the level of employees that they're engaging with at their client firms, it's, you know, it's pretty high. It's like directors and above. Sometimes it's all the way up to the C staff, and so they really want to also bring in folks that they feel like are going to be dropped into a very unique, very challenging situation, and be able to kind of lead themselves and potentially in the future lead a team out of it. And so I think, you know, in particular, maybe McKinsey has been the most structured about how they look for this. But I think all of the consulting firms in general are really looking for leadership skills. The other thing I would say that is evaluated and looked for in these interviews is what I will call basically just like authenticity. I think mm-hmm. that as these firms have become increasingly successful and the career paths that they offer, the compensation, all those things have become increasingly attractive to a large base of students. I think there are a lot of students that come into the process and they try and repeat what they think the firms want to hear. Rather than trying to look at their own kind of unique basket of skill sets and experiences, and really try and kind of like honestly and uniquely position themselves and highlight why they would be a great fit for that firm. So I think it's really, I think there's an element of basically finding the right way to present your unique skill sets to the firm that matters a lot, that a lot of students, I think, do end up glossing over.
Ironically, you have no idea how many MBA admissions directors and deans I've talked to who say the same thing about MBA applicants.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough, right? Because there are it's the same type of situation, right? Lots of students, candidates that want to get in. They know that it can be a kind of important trajectory, inflection point in a career, and it's one of those things that's like the fog of war takes over, right? And you get lost in the shuffle on it. Like you think you should kind of highlight certain things because you see that the school either talks about that on the website or the dean spoke about it or the admissions counselor mentioned it. And I think that the trap students fall into is that it's not that the school, or in many cases like the firm, you know, in my situation, it's not that they don't care about that. It's not like they mentioned it on their site, but they're not really looking for that. Mm-hmm. It's just when students, or in your case, you know, applicants, mm-hmm. are trying to convince someone that they fit for like reason X, but it's not true. It usually ends up being fairly obvious. Like I think that people have pretty good, essentially, like BS detectors.
Well, admissions directors should do. Counselors
or you know, the folks that are hiring at these firms.
Yeah.
And so that's the type of stuff that I think sticks out and is worth thinking about. Because usually, right. like a smart person that's at one of these top MBA schools, there will be some great reason that he or she would make a great asset to these consulting firms. And I think oftentimes they just end up trying to highlight the wrong things.
Right, right. Well, they end up blending in. They're doing what everybody else is trying to do as opposed to highlighting what they're particularly proud of.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting because it's, you know, it's a common challenge across many situations.
Oh, yeah.
In life,
yeah.
And success, right.
And people who are in charge of hiring or, you know, hiring consultants or admitting top MBA students are incredibly sensitive to authenticity in writing or in an interview or whatever. They've seen the real thing and they know it when they see it and they know when it's not there.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I had a friend who we interviewed recently for a blog post on the Rocket Block site who said something that I thought was a very good way of summing it up. And he did a bunch of interviews. He's done consulting interviews himself, but also on the other side of the table as the interviewer for Bain. And he said, I'll get the exact quote wrong, basically said, sometimes I feel like that the student walks in and it's like they've read like a video game manual or a cheat website, and they think if they just press the right order of buttons, they're going to get the job in. And he basically said, you know, he was like, I just want to talk to like a really smart human. I want someone to engage me, to pay attention, and just to have a really good discussion about a business problem. At the end of the day, that's what I care most about. I don't need someone to like draw their notes on the piece of the paper the right way, or like, you know, all these certain things that the kids are coached to do.
Right.
So that was a good way of summing it up.
It's very interesting because, I mean, again, for me, the parallels between trying to get these interviews at an elite company, and I assume when you were hired by Google, frankly, it was fairly similar. I mean, it may be different challenges, but the challenge of on one hand showing that you fit in, on the other hand you're going to contribute something distinctive. That's true. Distinctive and valuable. That's true whether you're applying to Google or to Harvard Business School or Tuck MBA or to Bain, BCG, or McKinsey.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it varies in each situation, but it's definitely true. Like I can tell you when I was applying to Google, I was very excited about the company, obviously, and very interested in potential jobs there. But when I ended up actually getting an initial interview, like a phone screen, after I did that, they told me, okay, we're interested in like bringing you to headquarters for interviews, but you don't come from a target school of ours at the time.
Yeah.
At the time, like the jobs I was looking at for them, they literally, the line was, we only hire from Harvard or Stanford for this role, and you're from University of Virginia. So we'll interview you, but we won't pay for you to fly up to California or your hotel.
Whoa.
And I was at UVA at the time, and I was a fourth year, so I didn't have a ton of money, and like I knew the chances of getting a role there were actually quite small. So like paying like $2,000 to fly cross country last minute, get a hotel, etc., just didn't seem like something I was gonna didn't seem like something that was gonna work out for me. So I ended up just responding and saying, you know, like, I was really excited about the interview. I continue to be really excited about the company, but if Google doesn't value me enough to even like pay to kind of bring me out to talk to more folks for a role that I know is competitive and a lot of other folks are interviewing for, maybe it's just like the wrong fit. Uh-huh. Maybe the interest isn't right. And they ended up getting back to me and saying, okay, if that's like a blocker for you, never mind. Like, we'll pay and we'll bring you out and we'll put you up and do all everything. And so I ended up going out, and then I obviously ended up taking that job.
Right.
But it was interesting because I think that actually, to some extent, got their attention. Like the tone of the recruiting conversations definitely changed after that point.
That's fascinating. Now, you set up Rocketbox for consulting, but do you see yourself developing similar tools for, let's say, product development or financial services or law or other fields?
Yeah,
high tech.
Good question. I think that I will say the short answer is yes, why not? Uh-huh. The slightly longer answer is that I think there is a lot still to be done to make Rocketbox like literally the best it can be for mm-hmm. consulting case interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy with where the product is today, but it doesn't mean that it's where it should be. Like, we've made good progress, but it could be a lot better. And so I think realistically we need to spend short, medium term really focusing on that. But long term, you know, I think our philosophy is that there are a lot of interviews out there that are similar, where there are core skills that companies are looking for, whether it's in financial services, whether it's in product development, whether it's in brand management, marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there's any reason why a skills-based interactive approach wouldn't work in those areas as well.
Okay. Now, let's go to your Tuck experience. You earned your MBA from Tuck in 2011 after a 3-year stint in product development at Google. Are you glad you went for your MBA?
That's a tough question. I think overall, yes. I think the experience and the value that, when I attribute value to my MBA, what I found most rewarding and excited about at this point is not initially what I thought I was going in for. So
really?
I think it's evolved.
How?
I was much more focused on the academic aspect of the MBA. And I a big part of my initial reason for going was that I was at Google before school and was getting this really great exposure to product development process, a bit of product marketing management, and basically building products. But when I looked at like the career path there and thought, like, if I ever want to own a P&L or run a small business or an element of the business at Google, like, it's going to be, you know, another 10, 15 years type thing, and maybe if it works out, I wanted to try and like essentially shortcut that path. And so I was interested in trying to gain some of those skills via business school, like understand more about like the financing side of the business, understand how to do basic accounting, learn more about capital markets. And so that was like a big impetus of actually going to business school for me. Now, when I look at it, even 2 years out, 3 years out, 5 years out, what I think about where the value actually came from was much less in terms of the actual immediate coursework,
mm-hmm.
And more I would attribute to having, you know, a really good group of lifelong friends that came out of that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had asked me beforehand, you know, is making like eight new lifelong friends, like really great lifelong friends, like the number one thing you want out of talk, I definitely would have said no. Is it what I think the most value came to from the experience right now? Yes.
That's really an interesting response.
It sounds a bit weird to essentially say it's like you basically paid for friends.
I was kind of thinking that, but...
I mean, in some way it does seem like that, but I think the older you get in like just life in general, like the at least
relationships.
For me and some of my friends that I spoke with, yeah, like the value of good relationships and like good people around you just goes up and up and up, and I think you become more cognizant of it. Certainly, I have.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I look at that and think, wow, you know, like. I actually went to talk at the same time with my girlfriend, who was also at Google before talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we look at that experience and we're like, we both did not go to talk with the intent of just like making friends and networking. Like there were other like much more academic aspirations, and both of us look at it and say, okay, we have like these eight friends that we made there that most of them now live in the Bay Area with us, and that's fantastic. And
oh, sure.
We really enjoy and value those people.
Did you achieve your academic goals?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think on like level one, yes. Like I learned a lot of basic stuff about finance, accounting, like capital markets that I had no idea about. I think the challenge is that if you don't reapply them immediately, that knowledge
right.
becomes rusty or you just lose it very quickly. And so
right.
I don't think that's, it's not Tuck's fault, it's not the professor's fault. It's just, I think it was a miscalculation of like, when is it the right time to acquire it, acquire that knowledge if you're not going to use it immediately. And so there's a bit of like a timing challenge. But I think what happened more than like the academic stuff did not happen. It was that there ended up being other much more valuable stuff, which is now what I think about as like the kind of core value of the program.
Well, I pursued a very non-traditional MBA path, and even more non-traditional then than today. And I certainly know what you mean about if you don't, you know, use it or lose it, and if you don't use it,
yep.
you lose it. Now, because... Yeah, I can definitely relate to that part of it. But you, I mean, in terms of your professional goal, you wanted to have P&L responsibility quickly. Obviously, you have it now. So you did shortchange, you know, that part of your goals you achieved. But your feedback is fascinating that on some level, you almost look at the primary benefit as social.
Yeah, and I think it's because... you're right that like the P&L responsibility is there now, and to some extent, actually, in my job immediately after after business school, which was at Zynga as a product manager, I ended up running a team there. I ended up getting that type of responsibility there as well. I think when I look back and consider like if you think about revisionist history,
sure,
there may have been other paths to get that P&L responsibility that didn't involve Tuck, but they certainly wouldn't involve like the network and the friends that ended up coming from it. So, for example, like, you know, in an alternate world, maybe I would have just left Google a year later than I did and then gone directly to Zynga. And I think that would have been entirely possible.
Right.
I don't think that, you know, Zynga cared particularly intensely about the fact that I had an MBA. So I think there were potentially alternate paths to it, and Tuck just happened to be one path that did lead to it, and it did lead to it, but I don't know that it was, there could have been, you know, it could have been one of, say, 10 paths that led to it.
Got it. How has your Tuck experience helped you in launching Rocket Blocks, or has it?
Good question. Let's say a few things. Well, certainly one, and maybe potentially the biggest, is it highlighted a certain problem that I wasn't aware of. which was there is a specific kind of type of interview and there's a way that folks are preparing that seems to be suboptimal. And my friend Nick and I thought there was a much better way, and that's, we're still on the mission of kind of proving that out, but certainly we have a lot of good signals so far just on feedback from students and the fact that the businesses continue to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that's one thing, like, it is hard to find the right problems to work on, especially if you think about one of the biggest challenges in the startup world is a lot of startups go put out product and technologies and really cool stuff, but it's basically tech in search of a problem.
Right.
And so this is kind of the reverse. We had the problem with how to build the right solution for it. I think the other thing that Tuck did a good job of is there's no concentrations, or at least no formal concentrations. Like, mm-hmm. you could take a bunch of finance courses if you wanted, but everyone comes out with general management. And I think it has a really good general management grounding, and I think also because Tuck is less steeped in like the Silicon Valley culture, which is where I've come from, there was like a lot of the examples we talked about in class and cases that we looked at were what I would call maybe more traditional business models than some of the stuff that comes out of the Valley these days. And I think where that's really useful is that ultimately in the tech world, I think people get new technologies confused or intermingled with new business models. And the reality is that there's a lot more innovation in the actual tech that's being provided than there is business models. And so I think there was value in the kind of corpus of talk academic lessons that I learned that helps kind of ground me in, okay, we're taking a slightly new approach from a tech standpoint to this problem, but it also needs to be built on like sound business principles. We need to figure out how to make this a business from the get-go.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that, Tuck is obviously very far away from Silicon Valley, where you lived before you went for your MBA and after you earned your MBA. Are you glad you went to Hanover, New Hampshire, far from Mountain View and Palo Alto and the whole high-tech startup scene that pervades Silicon Valley?
I think so. And I think the reason that it's – I think the reason I say yes is because I think contrast helps a lot in
mm-hmm.
life. It helps
mm-hmm.
when you have something that you really like and then you take it away or do something different for a while. It can help kind of illuminate what it is you liked about something, what traits, what skills, et cetera. And so I think after graduating from undergrad, I lived in the Bay Area for the first 3 years. My first first experience kind of back on the East Coast as an adult. And it just helped illuminate how much I enjoyed a lot of aspects about Bay Area culture and a lot of the companies and type of work that was out here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it provided a very good foil for that. And then on the flip side, like there's things that are incredible about Hanover that you just don't have out here, and it was fun to experience those for 2 years while I was there, even if like I might not choose to stay live in that environment for a decade straight. But being in like a small New England town,
yeah.
The camaraderie, just like the nice kind of like cozy atmosphere to it is fun for a little bit. And then also like when it's not freezing out and just freezing a good portion of the year.
Yeah.
And even there is fun stuff to do outside when it's freezing. But like before the you're buried in snow like the fall, spring there, and just like being able to go kayaking or canoeing or go on these like gorgeous hikes during fall and seeing the leaves change, like that stuff really is
beautiful,
special. I certainly don't get that out in the Bay. That type of specific environment. So that was very fun too.
Yeah. Well, as a fellow Californian, we don't have much of that here. I visited Tuck a few times, just very briefly, and it is gorgeous. I mean, the physical surroundings are magnificent.
Yeah, the scenery out there in like the Upper Valley is pretty incredible.
What could, other than the cold, what could you have done without when you were at Tuck?
That's a good question. I think that, and I don't think this is actually a Tuck specific problem, but I think from, you know, a fairly large network of friends that have gone to other top, at least top American MBA programs, as much fewer friends have done internationally. I think that, and I understand why it happens, but I think there is a bit of a, like a vortex that gets created at the MBA programs of sending kids down very specific career funnels. And from a school perspective, it makes sense because you get the students in, you want to get them high-paying jobs. There's a few big industries. Consulting, of course, is one of them that, like, open up a lot of opportunities, pay very well, they hire on fairly consistent timelines. It's all things that make it very nice from a school looking at, like, job placement rates, for example. But I do think that, like, having 2 years to take a break from your career, especially if you're in a full-time program, and really think about what you want to do is like a very special and like rare opportunity and like a privilege.
Right.
But I do think that the schools, it gets a little glossed over because they help kind of create the vortex of like, as soon as you're on campus, like go to these info sessions, like do this, like start dropping for the investment banks or the consulting firms. And it happens so quickly.
Yeah.
I would love to see a little more effort focused really on not the educate, like focused on helping students do career exploration itself, like really trying to like help them navigate what type of career is going to be fully rewarding in my life, and try and help students navigate that. And to be fair, I think it's a very tough problem because I don't know exactly what that would look like from their standpoint, but I think to the extent schools could do some of that, they would benefit long term, because I think they would produce like a really happy, successful alumni base, even if it's not just like, you know, more so than just looking at like short term, you know, placement rates and average first year salaries and sign on bonuses.
Right. I know many schools, and I completely agree with this, encourage applicants to think about what they really want to do post MBA before they apply.
Yeah.
And I know for many schools, it's actually one of the criteria for acceptance. You know, some schools don't care about it. And some schools, like I said, they want to see that the applicant knows the direction they want to take after the MBA. At the same time, I think realistically speaking, they all, you know, when you do take a step back, which in the MBA is such a step, and you're learning a lot, and you're meeting new people, and you're becoming aware of opportunities and routes that you never knew of before, sometimes things change, inevitably. And I'm going to guess it changed for you just because you took a consulting job in the summer between year one and year two, and then you decide to do something entirely different, you know, after you earn your MBA. But so I'm not sure that that's entirely the school's role, because many of them do say can start with a clear idea of direction. So it's really interesting feedback. Yeah,
I don't know that it is necessarily the school's role, but I would say it's as much their role as it is potentially just like funneling kids into one career path as the other.
Right. Right.
Where I would say that a decent amount of resources do go. And so, like I said, like I'm not, like, I don't know if it's a tough problem. I don't know exactly like how to solve it in the school's shoes. But I do think more emphasis on like workshops or thought, you know, like helping facilitate the thought process of what career path am I really looking for, I think would be interesting.
Right. That is also something they could possibly do from the moment of acceptance until people show up at orientation or through orientation or something like that.
Yeah, doesn't have to happen like specifically like the first day they show up. It certainly could start before,
right.
like you said. And I agree. Like I know some of the essay questions at the school specifically are like, where are you going to be in 5 years, et cetera. I do think when you talk to the students about like candidates to schools and like some of the advice like I remember getting as I was going through the process is people. I've heard many people say, you know, yeah, like I wrote the essay that was like I was going to go to business school and then I was going to move to, I can't remember, San Diego or something and like open up like a surf shop and build like a surf brand, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of one person in particular told me she wrote her essay about this and she ended up going to HBS.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things she said was, you know, I wrote that essay and I actually that was the honest, authentic answer. But she said, then I got to school and I felt a lot of pressure to do X or Y because that's what everyone else was doing. And that's what like all the info sessions and like yeah. the kind of like flow of the school was like.
Uh-huh.
And she just happened to go to HBS. I'm not picking on them because I think this,
right.
this does happen at a lot of schools. But it was almost like she almost got kind of persuaded off going that path.
Right.
And that I think is interesting. And that's the thing that I think to the extent the schools could at least make sure that they are not actively kind of pushing students into the career paths that will do the best job at maximizing placement rates, I think
right.
that would be a worthwhile endeavor.
I got it. Makes sense to me. What do you wish I would have asked you?
That's a good question. It's always a very tough question.
If you're happy with the questions, you don't have to answer.
I don't know. I don't know if I have. I don't know if there's like a burning question that we didn't talk about. It was a good list of stuff that we've already covered. I think the you know the question that is on my mind that I think is a very interesting question is like what do business schools look like in 5 years? Or like what are the things that business schools should really be changing to accommodate?
Okay.
That's something that I think is a very interesting question about like what the future holds for the schools and how do they adapt.
All right. How do you think business schools should be adapting to the present and the near term for future?
I think there is a lot that business schools should be doing to try and broaden the scope of like business skills they are teaching. I think in many instances they have focused very much on how to train students to go into large existing corporations and play very specific roles within those corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to see more kind of hands-on like business building skills in the focused on in the business schools themselves and maybe try and do that through simulation, maybe try and encourage it through active product projects or like incubation efforts that happen on campus. And I think mm-hmm. to some extent some of the West Coast schools are doing a little more of this now.
Right. Actually, I think HBS has, I think every student has to develop a business plan. Now, developing a business plan is step one in running a business. You also have to be able to scale a business. But
yeah.
I think it's really interesting what you're saying. Actually, the last interview I did was with Soojin Kwon of Ross, and they have a new dean.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. he wants to make sure that every Ross student, it's not going to happen this year, but either the next year or the year after, that every Ross student starts a business, runs a business, invests in a business, and advises a business. Because I would say yeah. that well over 90% of MBA grads are going to do exactly that when they graduate, if not sometime during their career.
Yep.
I thought that was a brilliant way to approach it.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the right mentality. I think getting more and doing it, I think, is tough, but it is, I think, a problem worth solving because those are the type of skill sets that these students will be utilizing and making use of, like, the rest of their careers. And the more experience they get hands-on, like, doing that, while they're in school, while the risk of failure is a lot lower, I think,
mm-hmm.
The better off everyone will be.
Great.
That's cool that Ross is pursuing that.
Yeah, it was when I read that interview and we discussed it also. I read it in an interview with the dean, and then I discussed it with the interview with Soojin Kwon And it was on one hand, it's such a simple kind of four key functions. I thought it was a great framework, actually. And just a fantastic way to approach business education that kind of goes away from the functional silos that business education has been married to since I was an MBA and probably, for decades before. So I was kind of blown away when I saw that particular quote. And then again, we discussed it then. But I think there, even since you attended, I think there is more of a move. First of all, the recruiting process is splintering. It's not quite the lockstep it was when you were going through it. It's definitely changing dramatically. And I think business schools are going to be responding to that. And entrepreneurship has gotten a lot bigger. Ironically, yeah. As entrepreneurship has grown and it's gotten a lot more attention, though, I don't think more grads are starting businesses right after graduation, probably because they have too much debt to do so.
Yep.
So, but, you worked full time and started something, did it on the side, and now you're running it full time. So maybe that's a model that we're going to see more and more.
Yep.
Kenton, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. I really appreciate your sharing your knowledge of RocketBlocks, your experience, your perspective on the Tuck MBA experience. Where can listeners learn more about RocketBlocks or try it out?
Well, first, thank you for having me on the show. This is great.
You're very welcome.
And if folks want to learn more about RocketBlocks, they can go to rocketblocks.me. That's our homepage, and they'll be able to learn all about the product from there and sign up if they're interested.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Kenton. We're going to link to RocketBlocks and related consulting-oriented podcasts and articles, as well as podcasts and articles relating to Tuck, including our Tuck Essay Tips, an interview with former admissions director Donna Clark, and interviews with other Tuckies, all from our show notes at exhibit.com/187. Listener, thank you too for tuning in to this, our 187th episode. If you're concerned that you missed something in today's show or wanted to take a note or two but couldn't because you were driving, jogging, or simply doing something else, we've done it for you. You'll find the show notes, as I mentioned, at exhibit.com/187. Finally, if you find this show worthwhile, please make sure you don't miss any others. Subscribe through your favorite podcatcher. We have subscribe links at the show notes at exhibit.com/187. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted. I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.